today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I was the rare case of the nice record store clerk. I wasn't a sarcastic, snarky clerk. Could have been, but everybody else I worked with was.
Hello, everybody. It is Rockin' the Suburbs. I am Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this recording. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I have with me today a voice who you may recognize from a recent series that we did on the Bee Gees, early music. And we got a lot of really nice feedback on that. But it is Paul Hayden out there in Wilmette, Illinois. Paul, how are you, man?
I'm good, Patrick. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to this topic. And I'm very curious, once we get started to this, to see the reaction of our listeners, because I think there are probably some people out there who may know, you know, a good amount about this topic. And then there may be others who may have heard it, the phrase anyway, that kind of goes with this, and then really not know too much more. Maybe they know it's a phrase or it's a movement of some kind. So we are going to talk today and over the next few episodes about the Paisley Underground. So I got to ask you, Paul, right off the top, why is this topic worth talking about, in your opinion?
Well, I think the songs have really held up over the years. I mean, it's been 40 years since the start.
Yeah.
And I think the DIY spirit of the bands is very relevant today. And I also think, you know, we're going to kind of focus on what I call the Big Four. And I think they each released a classic album that perhaps people aren't that familiar with. So I think it's worth talking about.
Absolutely agree. So I guess we start at the beginning. What is the Paisley Underground? It's not a shirt. It's not a place.
It's a movement. Let's call it a scene.
Okay.
Started in LA in the early 80s. Kind of born out of punk, but influenced by, you know, 60s rock and folk, psychedelia, garage, kind of like the Nuggets compilation.
Mm-hmm.
I think these bands all wanted to create music that wasn't really part of the mainstream or that AOR sound at the time. And, you know, they didn't want to make punk music, but they wanted that energy. And so they all went at it a different way and ended up all kind of coming together and starting the scene, which, you know, I think it's still... I think it's still pretty relevant today, and some of the bands people may not have heard of. I think they're all going to have heard of at least one, but I think their backstories are all worth telling, and that's what I'm here for.
Sweet. I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I think it's very interesting, and before we jump into the individual, the Big Four, what you mentioned about the influences... it was a kind of movement, at least for me, the way I understood it and got into it, that there was a freedom that punk rock gave people. It broke, you know, a lot of sort of rigid rules, you know, that were existing in rock music. And it's fascinating that they were able to combine that spirit, the freedom, yet take a very sort of... retro look at rock, folk, you know, psychedelic, garage, all these things like the Nugget set you mentioned. Obviously, the Birds are a huge influence here. All kinds of really interesting strains all come together in this scene. And I find that to be really fascinating. But also, I think, to your point, is a reason that the songs have held up over the years, because there was this rich background and rich set of influences.
Yes, I think they all played what they wanted to. They mm-hmm. followed their musical gut, and because of that punk spirit, the idea of releasing your own music, self-releasing it, wasn't just this fantasy. It was very doable. And Steve Wynn, who's going to kind of be the focal point of the discussion, because he was there. He was a buyer at a record store. It might be Rhino. I'm not clear if he was. He did work mm-hmm. at Rhino at some point, but he was the buyer in what they called the punk new wave department. And so he was very tuned in to what was going on, you know, kind of that post-punk era, 1980, 81. And yeah. he would listen to everything that came in. He was just very open-minded and just hungry to hear anything he could. And he really felt like there was a good scene out there and he wanted to be part of it. And I think that's he's a big part of this. And a lot of the material I'm going to go over is from this book. I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true, Steve's memoir that came out last year.
Yeah. And,
he has a lot of good detail in there about all the bands. So the other thing I wanted to point out, there really isn't a definitive book about Paisley Underground that I could find. 2012, I think a UK author whose name escapes me put out something that I could not find a copy of it. And doing a Google search, you'll find like different websites will have like, oh, it's the 20-year anniversary and here's a kind of a summary, but no real meaty story that's out there. So I'm kind of putting things together from different places and trying to create a cohesive story.
Very nice. Steve Wynn, of course, was the leader and founder of the Dream Syndicate. And what are the other three bands that go with the Dream Syndicate, Paul?
We're going to talk about the Dream Syndicate, the 3 O'Clock, the Bangs Bangles, and Rain Parade.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And there was an event that took place over July 4th weekend in 1982. Tell me a little bit about this. I don't know much about this at all. I found this a very interesting part of what our conversation is going to entail.
Yeah, I think what had happened starting in 1981 is each of these four mm-hmm. bands they kind of followed the same circuit without knowing it. I mean, I think they all thought they were doing something unique. And at some point they realized that they were either playing gigs together or they were attending shows where the other band was playing and said, wow, there are other people that are playing music in the same spirit as us. And through circumstances, they all kind of met and connected and decided they were going to take this trip out to Catalina. And it turned out to be a really big bonding event. It brought the community closer and they all, you know, kind of had each other's backs and were really supportive of each other. And I think that's what also helped keep the movement going, is that there was no jealousy, backstabbing. It's just like, you know, if someone makes it, that's great. But they all, you know, try to get gigs for each other and just kind of were a good kind of a team, I guess you could call it. And that's in large part because of that trip. And also Dan Stewart of Green on Red would host barbecues at his apartment complex on a regular basis. So between those two events, they became pretty tight and, you know, continued to make music and be supportive of each other.
Very cool. So it wasn't like they all sat down, you know, before they even had bands or anything and started to, you know, and said, here, we're going to form this ideological movement. It all kind of came together sort of as, you know, the bands were already formed and they were playing out.
Right. I mean, the name was kind of a not a joke exactly, but Michael Curcio was being interviewed in 82, and he was there. He was in a rehearsal space watching a friend's band perform. One of the musicians had on a paisley shirt, and the reporter was asking him, "So what do you call this? Is there a name for this movement?" And he just throws out Paisley Underground, and it's stuck. So it's just kind of one of those unique, that sounds good. And usually when you're not trying, that's when it sticks, right?
So why don't we start with the Dream Syndicate? You mentioned Steve Wynn. Kendra Smith was also a key member of this group. And they met when they were both DJs at a college radio station.
They did. This was back in 1979. So Steve had gone there to study rhetoric as a major, which I had never heard of as anything except a word. But I guess it's how you use language to either strengthen an argument or kind of get what you want, kind of a thing. So he was going to be a sports writer. That's what he wanted to do. But he was really into music, and his path was almost predestined where he couldn't get away from it. You know, he's a college DJ. He's playing all these great records that, you know, you're not going to hear on regular or radio, and then he meets Kendra Smith, kind of a kindred spirit, and they start talking about music and find out they have a lot in common. They end up going to shows together, and then they decide that, you know, Steve says, we should start a band, and Kendra really didn't have an instrument, so he said, just play bass and I'll show you some simple chords and let's see what happens. So they do that and put out self-released a single in 1979 under the name of The Suspects. Mm-hmm. And it did okay. I mean, for a local single, I think it did pretty well, enough to get them some gigs, but not enough to get them any real traction in the industry. And so they kind of played out, and by 1981, Steve was ready to move back to LA and pursue the sports writing, and he did that for a bit, but while he's doing that, he's working at a record store. And one day, two sisters come in, and they're going to sell their 7-inch single on consignment, which basically means here's 10 singles, and if you sell them, we get some of it, the record store gets some of it. If you don't sell any, we don't get anything. So you're kind of at the mercy of the record buyer.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So they did that, and Steve played it, and he really liked it. And the next time they came in to see how things were going, he asked if they'd like to, you know, jam and play some music. And they said, sure. And he came over to their apartment and they played. And Steve thought it was really good until he told them they sound like the Shags.
And when, oh, no.
When the girls who hadn't heard of the Shags found out what the Shags sounded like, they didn't really appreciate it. So
compliment to them.
Yeah. But they got over and Steve said, you know, we need a bass player. They had, I guess, one of the sisters played guitar, the other played drums, and they needed a bass player. So they put an ad in the paper. And the only person to respond is Carl Percoda, who was a guitar player. He was playing in another local band and getting gigs. I'm not sure. It was in the Los Angeles area, but he just wanted to do something else. He wasn't happy with where he was. So he jams a few times. And at the end of one of the practices, Steve and Carl are out getting ready to leave. And Carl says to Steve, you know, hey, I really don't like their music, but I really would like to play just with you and see what happens. And Steve's like, yeah, let's give it a shot. And turns out they were, you know, musical spirits, and they were able to get a good sound going and good enough where I think Steve felt like he could leave those sisters behind and call up Kendra Smith and see if she's willing to come out and play some bass and see what happens. And she does, and it sounded really, really good. And then now next thing is, well, we need a drummer. So Kendra says, I know a guy, Dennis Duck. Mm-hmm. I'll see if he wants to come out. Well, Dennis Duck at the time was a drummer for a local band called Human Hands.
And they were Human Hands.
Human Hands. And they were pretty big.
Yep.
In that area. And they were getting regular gigs. And Steve Wynn's just like, there's no way this guy's going to leave his gig. Established local band to play with us, no names. But he agreed to make the drive. Is about an hour from Pasadena up to where they were playing. And as he's setting up his drum kit, he says, do you mind if I record this? And he's like, sure, no problem. And so they jam for about an hour or so. And then Dennis says, yeah, I got to go. It's another hour back. And that was it. And so this, I think, was on a Friday. And they didn't hear anything for a couple of days. And I think it was a Tuesday. And Steve asked Kendra, go, I haven't heard from Dennis. What do you think I should do? She's like, call him. What do you got to lose? So he says, all right. So he calls him. Hey, Dennis, it's Steve. Yeah, we played together Friday night. And just wondering, you know, what you thought. And he said, Dennis said it was the best thing he'd heard in a long time. He'd been playing the tape over and over the past few days and said, I want to join your band.
Wow.
So Steve was ecstatic. They were all ecstatic. And they felt like they really had something different, something they all enjoyed and were passionate about. And so they were ready to make the next step, record something. It turns out to be an EP because Steve had written a few songs and then Carl had written one. So that was the next step.
Amazing. And, you know, like you said, Human Hands was a pretty established band that had a couple singles out, and it was quite a thing that he left that group to come play with what would become the Dream Syndicate. So that's pretty cool. It really is.
Steve had to feel like this is happening for a reason. Like, everything's really lined up. You know, I think this is going to be big. So they didn't have a name. Dennis suggested the name Dream Syndicate, which was not, I guess I found out later that it wasn't named after this 1960s New York avant-garde outfit with Lamont Young and John Cale. It was the mm-hmm. name of an album, one of those prog bands whose name escapes me, but the album title had Dream Syndicate in it. And Dennis said,
oh, interesting.
And so he thought, when he kept listening to it, he thought that Dream Syndicate, that's a great name for a band, but he was in a band.
Absolutely.
Now there you go. So they record what's called the 15 minutes EP, and Steve named it that because he figured this was my 15 minutes of fame. I'm not going to do anything after this, so let's just kind of call it that. I can always say I made a record, no matter what. And as they started gigging more and getting more used to playing and getting a sound, they started picking up a following for people who were looking for something different, weren't happy with the mainstream, and eager to hear, you know, some good guitar players, and they would really stretch things out, kind of like the Velvet Underground, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, Television, that kind of thing. Didn't sound like any of them, but it was that same vibe. There were enough people out there to listen to it and follow them that, yeah, they became kind of a big local band at this time, kind of like Human Hands. So things were definitely going the right way. And then later in 1982, they end up going into a recording studio. I believe it was with Chris D from the Flesh Eaters, who either owned a studio or knew of a studio where they could record. And of course, you know, you're not going to get the prime hours. You're going to get the 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. You know,
that's right.
the cheap stuff.
But I think they got that for 3 days. And that's when they recorded The Days of Wine and Roses, which I think is their kind of their definitive statement. It's really a strong record with a lot of different styles, and yet they all come together. You know, I think it took a lot of heat for being maybe a little too Velvet Underground-like, but I disagree. There are aspects of it, but I think they're doing their own thing. It's their own voice, and it really, in the end, turned out to be a big, big thing. You know, it was the top of almost every independent album list of, you know, top tens or whatever. They were big, and people were starting to follow them, and to the point where R.E.M. asked them to open for them on their tour. I'm not sure of the year. You may know that, Patrick.
Yeah, it must have been pretty early on, right? Because I think it was a tour of fairly small places, even though R.E.M. had started to get pretty big at that time. The record was released in 82, so it's got to be, you know, around that Murmur, maybe between Murmur and Reckoning is probably my best guess.
I think that's right, because I saw them in 84, and by then they were, the DBs opened.
Okay.
And by 84, the Dream Syndicate were already, I think, on a major label.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Probably not touring as an opening band. So yeah, 83 sounds right. And you know, I think going back to the album, which in my mind, you know, in my world, these are standards, you know, that's what you always say, and tell me when it's over.
Yes.
It really does flow so well.
What you always say.
you've got, you know, Tell Me When It's Over starts. It's kind of that classic melodic, good hook. And then it goes on to Definitely Clean, Ripper. And That's What You Always Say, which I think is probably my favorite song of theirs. It never gets
tremendous song.
Then the rails come off with Then She Remembers. That's just a out there song. And they kind of bring it down for Halloween, which is, again, it's kind of slow, but at the end it kind of builds into this guitar freakout, which they were so good at. And then on the vinyl, you get a chance to kind of relax, flip it over. And When You Smile comes on, which is another good one. More good guitar. And then Until Lately, we're getting a little crazy now. Now, one of my other favorites is Too Little Too Late, which is a...
Yes.
Kendra sings that one, and it's kind of like that calm before the storm of the last song, where she just kind of, you know, it's just a beautiful version, and she sounds just so comfortable. I mean, it's not perfect. It's not, you know, I don't know what the word is, if in tune or on pitch. Well, I don't know. I'm not a singer, but it's just got that charm that kind of like Nico had on the
first,
you know, and there's just something about it. That leads you into the title track, just 7 minutes of mayhem, and it's just an exhilarating album. I just love it. I want to play it right now, actually. It's so
so do I. It's funny, talking about side two. We used to always, back in the day, me and the small Disturbed group of music friends that I hung around with, you know, we always had a thing where it was like, okay, you get a side now, if we're all sitting around drinking beer and, you know, hanging out or whatever. You play a side. And we used to always play side one of the Dream Syndicate's Days of Wine and Roses. And then one day my friend Dave McChesney, I'll never forget this, said, before you put on side one, let's listen to side two once, okay? And then we started getting really into side two. It's almost like that album where you're like, well, there's so, you know, the first five songs are just incredible on this record. And I agree with you, they're standards. But the side two has got these beautiful gems. I mean, there's not a bad song in this record. The guitar interplay between Carl Percota and Steve Wynn is amazing. I mean, for a band's debut album to, you know, to have that kind of chemistry and that kind of ability to just, you know, like you said, go off the rails or short circuit. I mean, it sounds like stuff's blowing up at times. It's just amazing. And I agree with what you said earlier too. I mean, I like the fact that when you first started listening to this record, it reminded you of the Velvet Underground, and that was okay. Cause you love the Velvet Underground and you was like, well, are these Velvet Underground songs? Like, are these, you know, I don't know what these are. But then the more you listen to it, their individual charm and, you know, abilities and talent all start to really come to the fore, especially, I think, Kinder Smith's bass playing. You know, there's just some great bass hooks on this record that have to be there with the drums, because when the guitars are flying off in every direction like that, you've got to have something, you know, to hang on to. So I never got to see the Dream City Kid in the early days or anything, but I can imagine there were times where she was up there holding the whole thing together with Duck, you know, for a good 10, 15 minutes while they were going crazy with the guitars. But it's just a monumental record. It really is. It's one of the best debuts, full length debut albums you could ever think of.
Yeah, it's crazy when you run across these bands that seem fully formed right from the get go.
Yeah.
How do they do it? And, you know, they had all the right ingredients and everything you just mentioned. It all had to be there. Take any one of them out and it's not the same. And that's kind of what happens if you want to take a look at what happened afterwards. Kendra left. She did not like touring. She was a homebody, and I can't imagine what it was like in 1983 being a woman in a band, and probably not the greatest environment to be in, and I can't blame her.
No, not at all.
So they went on and they signed to a major label, which is another kind of a trend in this story. You know, the record companies got wind of this. You know, there's a scene brewing, and let's see if we can capitalize. And so they signed to A&M, and second album was The Medicine Show, and that was just kind of the start of the end of the first version of the Dream Syndicate. But in the end, I mean, they're still together. They're touring. Haven't toured in a while. Steve Wynn spent a lot of last year with both the Baseball Project and a solo tour. So I'm hoping maybe next year they get back out on the road and I get a chance to see them.
That would be great. Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing about, you know, that second album, The Medicine Show, when they signed to A&M, they put the Dream Syndicate with Sandy Pearlman, who had produced Blue Oyster Cult and The Clash, right? And that just was not... There are moments. I mean, the song John Coltrane Stereo Blues remains a great Dream Syndicate song. But, you know, a lot of it is just... Like you were talking about with Kendra Smith's voice, the way the rough edges were kind of in there, you know, like the elbows are sticking out. It wasn't perfectly... you know, beautifully formed, but that's what gave it its charm. And that's kind of what got scrubbed away in the preceding albums. So, yeah, it's too bad because what a magical first record, you know, they put out. And the other thing that always struck me about the Days of Wine and Roses is the cover. Like, wait a minute, this isn't a rock and roll cover, right? It's got like a big blue field, you know, it's just like a blue rectangle with the writing on there. And it's like, the more you think about it, the more you listen to the album, the more you love it, like the more classic and simple and streamlined that seems. It just all works. It really does.
It does. And if you look at the top left, there's stereo.
Stereo, right.
And the font and the coloring, it's almost like a jazz.
It is.
Maybe that's what they were going for. Yeah, it is.
Maybe.
I love the cover too.
Yeah, it's so cool. It really is. Yeah, a little classic avant-garde, maybe like a Blue Note kind of a layout. It's just excellent.
Yep. We'll be right back.
there was a freedom that punk rock gave people.